You must be listening to the Goblin Broadcast Network at gbn.com. Amazing.
Gilroy 2.0 is here. Gilroy 2.0 is everywhere. Gilroy 2.0 is delighted. He just rolled a natural 20 listening to The Tome.
Welcome to episode 33. I am your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. The Tome is a D&D news review and interview podcast, and in this episode, we will be sorting out all things magical with Complete Arcane. Welcome again to episode 33 of The Tome, Complete Arcane. I know it's an older book, and that was sort of the idea. Will and I got together, and really Will did most of the reviewing here. I just did a little bit of recording, and we did a different format for the review, something that I've been thinking about doing more and more often for a while now, something I thought might be interesting, just to add another voice to the show. If anybody's interested in participating in something like this in the future, let me know. But Will and I did, or Will did a review of Complete Arcane as a sort of two-way thing with in a conversation with me on the phone, and I'm curious to see what people think about it. So I'm going to play a quick little promo of a show that I've been really enjoying lately that I think you might enjoy. Check it out, and then you'll get right into Complete Arcane with Will.
Hey everybody, I wanted to tell you about this great podcast on role-playing I've discovered called Midnight's Lair. It's these two guys, Luke and Eric from Canada. And they talk about different role-playing genres and give in-depth reviews of game systems. They even have regular extras like the Cruel Humor segment, which features a different gamer joke every week, and Gaming Ether by Doc Holliday. He talks about what gamers can learn from old-time radio dramas. I tell ya, these guys really know what they're doing. Listen to this.
How do you say that? Is it any or eeny? Okay, let's just do the whole thing over again.
Let's at least stop where we started making sense.
Before we started making sense. It sounds appropriate.
Hi, in today's main event, we're going to... I quote, as an aside on a completely different topic, I shouldn't have read that.
Oh, I know now that's not going on the show.
Okay, maybe not, but there really is lots of great talk about role-playing games on Midnight's Lair. Episodes have covered things like swashbuckling, space opera, superhero adventures, and role-playing in horror games. I tell you, the show is first rate. In fact, Eric described it as the,
perhaps the genesis of all modern media. Stop playing and listen, dammit! I'm Eric.
And I'm Luke.
Join us at www.midnightslayer.com.
First of all, of course, welcome to The Tome. I'm excited to sort of try out this call-in system for doing interviews and doing possible more than one person reviews and that sort of thing. So thanks for being an early guinea pig for me on that, and I hope everything goes smoothly.
Yay, I'm a guinea pig.
Why don't you quickly, since this is your first time reporting for The Tome, why don't you quickly introduce yourself to the listeners?
All right, well, I'm Will. I've been playing D&D for 20, 21 years, something. I don't know. More or less since I was capable of rolling dice and adding two numbers together.
Well, okay. Will is going to be talking to us a little bit about the book Complete Arcane, which came out several years ago now, hasn't it?
Is it several? Oh, wow. So it's first printing November 2004. So, yeah, we can call it 2.5 years.
All right. Good deal.
It's longer than I thought.
Right. It's been out for a little while, and it's sort of the... I don't know. I did a review earlier on the show for Complete Mage, which is sort of, in many ways, a follow-up. It follows up on a lot of the things that are in Complete Arcane originally.
Yes.
So why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about your first impressions with the book?
Well, I think it's got three new base classes. Wizards of the Coast has decided that every book shall have new base classes, just to confuse people.
Right.
It has... a ton of prestige classes. I counted them up. There's 19. Some of them are entirely pointless as far as I'm concerned. There's a whole bunch of more new feats. Any book called Complete Arcane should have, as this does, 30-odd pages worth of new spells. This is the book that gives us the Warlock and Invocations, which are later used in Dragon Magic for the Dragonfire Adept.
It seems to me that the Warlock specifically has come up a lot since this book came out. It's showed up in a lot of different supplements.
It's because he's so unique. He doesn't use regular spells or anything, so he's got to have his own stuff.
Well, good. So why don't we just go ahead and dive right into that review then?
Okay, the first chapter is the three new classes, the Warlock, the War Mage, and the Wu Gen.
I don't know, the War Mage doesn't seem quite as unique to me. It seems like that could have very easily have been a prestige class or something else. I don't know why we needed to add a whole other core class for that one. Maybe you can tell us a little more about it.
Oh, well, yes and no. As far as my take on the War Mage is basically that it's the specialist wizard, but it's sort of the sorcery answer to it. It's the sorcerer version of an evoker specialist.
Oh,
and it gets
okay.
to wear armor, which is cool.
That works well.
It gets to wear armor. It gets D6s for hit points. What else have I got written down here? He gets to add his intelligence to his spell damage or his intelligence bonus.
So that's the War Mage. Let's take it back a step and tell us. We mentioned the Warlock has been a very highly used, very unique sort of class that was introduced in this book. Tell us a little bit about what the Warlock class is all about.
The Warlock class is somebody who has, in this one, it only gives demonic or fiendish. No, I think it's only demonic blood somewhere in their family line, and it manifests in this person, and they get crazy supernatural abilities. I know in Complete Mage they introduce the possibility of fae or maybe celestial. I'm not sure, but they introduce other possibilities for where his power comes from. All of his powers are invocations, which is spell-like abilities that can all be used at will. He gets there's four ranks to his powers. He's got, they're least, lesser, great, and dark. Every rank is roughly equivalent to two spell levels. So the least ones, you get spells like Shatter or Endure Elements. And the dark ones, you get crazy stuff like Supreme Invisibility or Wall of Force. Their primary attack is a ranged touch ability. The original book says that it's not an invocation, but it's I checked the errata, it is an invocation. And it does a D6 for every odd level, so it progresses the same as rogue sneak attack damage. And there's two types of other invocations other than ones that duplicate spell effects. There's essence invocations and blast shape invocations, which make it do other weird stuff and have area effects. For example, you can have it be a cone. That is an example of a blast shape. And the essence ones all do stuff like, now, instead of it being magic, it's acid, so you save or you burn two more rounds, and it will ignore spell resistance.
Okay, very cool. Seems like the invocations do add a slightly new level of complexity to a spellcasting class. It's not your standard spells. It's a whole new system that you sort of have to learn, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. You don't actually have to learn anything because there's no math to do. There's no spells per day. Your guy just, you look at your chart and you go, okay, I know this many for whatever level you're going to be. You take them and that's what you got. You know, this many lesser, you know, this many least, and maybe like one greater. And those are the ones you've got to work with. End of story.
Well, okay, then. That's the Warlock, and we heard about the War Mage. Let's talk about that third class, then. Tell me about, a little bit about the Wu Jin.
All right. The Wu Jin is more of a, is more traditional than the other two. They don't wear any armor. They have D4 for hit points, and they cast with intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
All right. They have a totally different spell list and from everybody else, and They get bonus feats and, or in place of bonus feats, as a, like a wizard would get, they get spell secrets.
What is a spell secret? Can you explain what that is?
Every three levels, except for six, the Wu Jin gets a spell secret, and they get that lets them pick a spell to permanently add one of four metamagic feats: enlarge, extend, silent, or still, and that will not affect the level that it casts as. And they can, at three, they can put, you know, they can put one on, say, Magic Missile. And then they get, at nine, when they get another one, they can put a different one on Magic Missile. So they can stack all four on one spell or just spread them out or whatever.
Okay.
Or they can,
It's a way to sort of get the benefit of some of those metamagic feat abilities without having to burn a higher level spell slot for it.
Right. The price for those is they get more taboos, stuff like cannot sit facing east or cannot start a fire. And then a six instead of a spell secret, they get an elemental specialty. Some of the Wu Jin spells are broken up into the five Taoist elements, which are metal, earth, fire, water, and wood. And they get +2 to their caster level and +2 to save against any spell that has that element to it.
So it's they have an elemental sort of bent to them, the Wu Jin do.
They do.
So what's sort of the flavor of the Wu Jin? I mean, we've sort of talked about their abilities and the stats and sort of how the numbers work for them. But if I want to consider, you know, whether or not I want to play a Wu Jin, what kind of character am I going to end up playing?
Well, the book describes them as Oriental Arcanists who generally grow up wanting to learn about these kinds of to learn about magic, but in a place that doesn't have organized colleges or guilds or anything like that. So they tend to be outcasts or hermits who learn all of this stuff from another Wu Jin as an apprentice sort of deal.
Your outcast, less organized, you know, not lawful sort of character there.
Right, they cannot be lawful. I forgot to mention that.
Great. So the next chapter, chapter 2, then talks about prestige classes. Yes.
Yes, there are 19 of them. A couple of them return from Tome and Blood, the old 3.0 edition.
So they've updated a lot of the classes that we saw in older books. So they've turned them into 3.5 books now.
Not a lot of them, but yeah, they have.
Okay. So why don't you go through and quickly summarize what we can expect as far as the prestige classes.
All right. Alphabetically, as presented in the book, you've got the Acolyte of the Skin. But their deal is they graft parts of the demon skin onto themselves through some forbidden ritual, and that gives them powers. Then you got the Alienist, which is one of my favorites. They're the very Cthulhu mythos caster. They lose sanity and they learn secrets of the universe from the unspeakable things from the far reaches. Then there's the Argent Savant, which is a force specialist mage, like Magic Missile and Wall of Force and the Bigby Hands. They're kind of neat. I didn't see anything particularly amazing about them. I thought they would have been better as a 10-level prestige class instead of 5, though, as they don't seem to gain anything spectacular. Next is the Blood Magus. In order to be one of these, you have to have died and been raised, which is sort of got to be the toughest one yet to get into. Up until the very end, their big abilities are they can brew and store potions in their own body as part of their blood, and they can either ignore spell components or boost the power of a spell by pricking their finger and spending a hit point in blood. And they only lose 2 casting levels.
Okay, so even though they're not highly impressive, you don't lose much by taking this prestige class, because you still get all the casting, most of the casting that you would have gotten if you just stayed as a straight sorcerer or wizard or whatever.
Right. So the next one is the Effigy Master. It's only a 5-level class. And his deal is he makes a mechanical version of a creature, like, say, a dire lion, I believe is the example in the book.
So you give up a caster level and you end up being able to create mechanical constructs sort of as your pseudo-animal companion?
Yeah. It's mechanical, so it costs money, but whatever. It's not like any D&D game wasn't swimming in gold. Next up is the Elemental Savant, which I thought was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. The Elemental Savant, if I remember, is one that was brought over from Tome and Blood.
Yeah. It requires Elemental Substitution, which is one of my favorite feats. They choose an element, and then they get quite a lot of bonuses to use. They get damage bonus with that. It's harder to save against it, I think. All of their damage spells are automatically substituted over to their chosen element, and then they gain stuff like damage resistance to that element and all these things, until finally their type changes over to elemental. Then you've got a weird one. The next one is the Enlightened Fist. It's sort of a mage-monk hybrid. They continue to gain the monk passive abilities, like running and unarmed damage, as they level. And they get a caster level more almost every level. I think they lose 2. All right, next we got the Fate Spinner. It's a 5-level prestige class, and it's a luck mage. It doesn't lose any caster levels. Every level he gets an ability, they're all once a day, and only the very last one is impressive at all. I did not like this class. Then there's another fairly pointless one, the Geometer. It's a 5-level class. It doesn't take anything for a wizard to get into. It's something like must write down spells, I think is what it takes to get into it.
Okay.
And their class is all about runes and glyphs. They get the ability to find, as a rogue, any trap that involves magic runes, glyphs, things like that. They can compress their spellbook down so that it's cheaper and easier to carry using special and intricate runes. The next one is the Green Star Adept, which I see no point at all in. They use the metal that comes from this special comet to... And they brew it into some kind of elixir, and over time they slowly become a construct.
This one always seemed really out of place to me. Like somebody had a homebrew campaign world, and this meant something to them. But I don't know, unless it seems like it's part of a larger story, this prestige class doesn't seem to have a whole heck of a lot that fits, you know?
Yeah, it's just one of those things. I feel the same way about any class, any prestige class, that their whole big deal is, you know, we belong to this group. What if I don't want to have the group in my game? What if I don't want a magic comet in my game?
Right. It's certainly, by having this prestige class, it assumes certain things about your campaign world. So.
Right.
You definitely want to check with a DM before you wanted to start playing something like that.
Right, and you know this is never going to be mentioned again in other books. You're never going to hear about, oh, the Comet of whatever is back, and you're never going to see an epic adventure about it.
Right, and to my knowledge, that Green Star Adept concept has not shown up in any other books that I can think of.
Yeah. Oh, well, the next one is cool, at least. It's the Initiate of the Sevenfold Veil. My only problem with this prestige class is it requires you to be level 9, at least. You have to be able to cast, I think, one of the 5th-level prismatic spells.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's the only 7-level prestige class that I know of. And every level they get a new ability based around one of the colors of the prismatic wards, or of the prismatic wall. And every their whole thing is wards. So at the first level they get red, and then they get orange, I think. And every time something tries to cross the ward, each one of these has an effect. Like, I remember red is, it's 20 points of fire damage. And then the last one, I think violet, if you cross that, you save or be disintegrated. And the next one is Mage of the Arcane Order. It's one of those classes that assumes there's this group of wizards somewhere out there. It's a 10-level wizard, almost wizard-only prestige class. It's almost exactly the same thing as continuing on as a wizard. The only real difference is things to do with the mages, the arcane order itself, and the spell pool, which is complicated, but it lets you sort of pull a spell out of the air like a sorcerer would. But then you owe the guild, so you go, okay, I pulled Lightning Bolt out, so I owe them a third level spell, or I owe them three levels worth of spell.
Okay. I wonder if this book were to be written today, if this class would even exist, because Wizards of the Coast has been really pushing all the new rules for being members of organizations and stuff, if they wouldn't just do it that way instead.
They might. I'm not really into the affiliation rules, you mean?
Right, right.
Is what I think they're calling them?
Right.
Yeah, I'm not into those. I think they're silly.
I haven't gotten into them at all either, but it seems to be absolutely everywhere. I haven't picked up a magazine or a book in the last, 6 months that didn't have a whole section on affiliations in it.
All right. The next one, one I thought was really cool, is the Master Transmogrifist. It's cool, but it's hard to say. He's a 10-level class. He loses 4 levels of casting, but he gains some really cool abilities at the end. The class is all about polymorphing. It's the polymorph prestige class.
Okay.
All right. He gets a couple of things, like he can automatically add still and silent to his alter self and polymorph spells around mid-level. I think they all start lasting longer. His alter self becomes permanent. And then at 8, he gets his coolest ability, which is all of the abilities of a form that he takes, he gains. Like, let's say he turns into a sort of small red dragon if he doesn't have the hit dice for it. He gets all the red dragon abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Or an Umber Hulk, or an Ogre Mage, or he's hurt and he just needs the regen of a troll.
That is an incredibly useful ability.
Yeah, but they very intelligently put something in there to slow it down. I think he only gets to pick 3 favored forms when he takes his class, and I think every 3 levels after that he gets to pick another form.
Okay.
And those are the only ones that he gets the level 8 craziness on. And the next class is Mindbender, who is all about charm spells. It loses 5 levels of casting. It's a 10-level class. It gains a suggestion. I think it lasts 24 hours or something ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Every level that he does not gain a level of casting, he gets the ability to permanently charm one more person.
All right, so next up,
we got 2 bard ones. I did not like either one of them, in part because you have to be level 10 to go into this class. The first one is the Seeker of the Song. And the idea behind this is there's primal music, like music of the spheres kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they pursue this instead of bard spells. So they get more songs per day and songs that do different stuff. And they can, I think, play 2 songs at a time. Things like that.
Okay.
And the other bard one is called the Sublime Chord, which also takes level 10. But this one gains spells and sacrifices songs. It gets spells up to level 9 and gives up, I think, it gains songs half as fast as it would if it had stayed a bard.
So they're both sort of doing the same thing in opposite, well, they're doing the opposite thing, really. One of them gives up magic to get more music, and the other one gets rid of music to get more magic.
Well, neither one of them gets rid of, but they very much de-emphasize those.
Right.
All right, the next one is the, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, it's the Seul Arcanimach.
And as close as I could get.
It looks like it was built from the ground up to be a mage killer. It gets spells up to level 5, but its big deal is called Dispelling Strike. It can, once per day as a normal melee, blah, 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 like the Paladin Smite. If he hits, he declares, I'm going to use my Dispelling Strike, and if he hits, it's the same effect as a greater dispel. The next class is the Wayfarer Guide, which is all about teleporting. And this really seems like an NPC sort of get-out-of-jail class.
Sure.
Oh no, we're doomed. Use the scroll to call the Wayfarers to teleport us away.
Right.
Something like that.
This one is based out of some sort of organization too, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I
think the Wayfarer Union or something like that.
Yeah.
And
the last, one more, right?
Yep. The last one is the Wild Mage.
All right.
I think it's a weird one for a PC, but it would work really well for some crazy hermit-style NPC.
Mm-hmm.
The way the Wild Mage works is you subtract 3 from your caster level whenever you cast a spell that has anything to do with your level, and then you add a d6. So your caster level varies from 2 under to 3 over what your actual level is.
Okay.
And then as they level, wild mages also get chaos-based abilities like Rod of Wonder is something that they mention a couple of times for this class. You get to roll twice and pick which result you like.
Okay.
And I think once a day they can just decide that whoever's trying to shoot them shoots somebody else instead, or it just magically deflects to somebody else.
And that finishes up Chapter 2, doesn't it?
That is. That is the end of Chapter 2.
Chapter 3 is Arcane Feats, then. Good, good. And let's get a highlight of what kind of feats they offer here in Chapter 3.
All right. There were a lot of good feats, so it's...
Sure.
All right. First one I liked was Arcane Preparation. This one lets a spontaneous caster, such as a sorcerer, set aside any number of slots to just assume, this one is going to have extended spell on it, and it won't take any longer to cast.
Okay, so it's a way for a sorcerer to prepare spells like a wizard, so they can
more or less. Next I've got a set of feats I called extra things, like extra spell, extra invocation, or extra slot. It gives you an extra whatever of under the highest level you can cast. So if you took this at level 6 as a sorcerer, you could take an extra second or first level slot.
Okay.
I thought this was especially important for the warlock because he gets a very limited number of invocations per day,
Yeah, I think this would be useful for a lot of different spellcasters. You know, if you can't think of what feat to take, this seems like a good pick just to get more spells.
Yeah, just default to this. All right, the next three are what I call the Mage Slayer line. The first one is called Mage Slayer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It gives a +1 to will save, and no enemies that are in squares that you threaten can cast defensively.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah, they know they can't, but that doesn't matter. The whole point of that is you can't cast defensively. I'm going to smack you.
Right.
All right.
And then they've got to start making concentration checks for taking damage. And I could tell that would be very, very effective taking on a spellcaster.
Yep. And I got to mention that all three of the Mage Slayer abilities, or all three of the feats, each one of those costs you 4 levels of casting. Like, if a paladin were to take it, he would cast as 4 levels lower. This is very much a fighter or rogue ability.
You bet.
The next one is Pierce Magical Concealment. It requires Mage Slayer. It lets you ignore the effect of any concealment spell. It gave as examples blur and darkness, and it flat out negates mirror image.
Okay.
And the next one is pierce magical protection. I think it just requires Mage Slayer, not pierce concealment. It lets you make a normal melee attack that ignores all the armor bonuses from spells like Mage Armor, and if you hit and do damage, it will dispel them automatically.
Oh wow.
The next one, and this is a very good feat, I can't believe it didn't come out sooner, is a practiced spellcaster. It makes you count as your caster level being four levels higher, but it can't be higher than you have hit dice. So this lets you functionally multi-class, finally,
okay.
into a casting class.
That's
you,
cool.
You won't, yeah, it doesn't affect your spells per day or anything, but now a fighter multi-classing into cleric isn't going to be completely pointless going, oh, let me roll my d8 plus 1.
Right.
I'm level 9, I'm rolling plus 1.
This is a way that your wizard could pick up 4 levels of fighter and still get that, you know,
right, and
bigger fireball, you know.
Right. He got the fireball, now he's happy, so he can take something else.
Right. Very cool.
All right, and then the next things I've got are two different sets of feats. There's the sudden metamagic feats.
Mm-hmm.
All six, I think, of the basic metamagic feats from the player's handbook can be taken as sudden, which is once per day you can as a free action decide I'm going to sudden whatever feat a spell. And it doesn't cost any levels. So you can suddenly maximize a fireball as level 3 once a day. So
okay. So it allows
I thought
you
that
to,
was really cool.
Basically, you give up a feat. You use this feat to be able to use your metamagic feat without the spell level cost.
And then there's the set of heritage feats. This one's got the draconic feats. I know Complete Mage has Celestial and Demonic or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. They add more into the heritage feat for that book.
Right.
But this one
I don't know.
Focuses on Draconic then?
Right.
Okay.
Some of those are Draconic or Dragon Breath, Draconic Power, and Draconic Legacy. The Breath is a breath weapon that you power by spending spell slots for a day. A draconic power gives your spells that share the type of breath weapon that you chose plus 1 to caster level and difficulty against saving. And legacy, you get to add. Sorry, not add. You would just know more spells depending on the type.
Okay.
There's a big chart. Every dragon has, I think, 3 spells that you would learn.
So the basic idea there is that you've got some sort of you're a sorcerer and you've got some sort of connection to some sort of magical creatures out there, in this case draconic creatures, dragons, and so you can start taking feats to sort of tap into that racial potential, that potential in your heritage, in your blood.
Right, and a couple of them get better the more feats you have, and some of them require you to have so many draconic heritage feats.
That finishes up feats, does it?
It does. So many feats.
All right. So we are now into chapter 4, which is where we get the whole slew of spells and invocations and all that kind of stuff. So
yep. And
I imagine you want to highlight some of those for us.
I will. I'm going to do invocations separately.
Okay.
Because it's less confusing. That's the way the book has them set up.
Okay.
All right. The first one that I really liked was Dancing Blade. It's a level 4 Wujin metal spell. It animates a sword, so you actually have to have a sword, for one round per caster level. And the sword will fight, it will assist anybody you tell it to, and it will use that character's base attack and initiative. The sword will also move to prevent people from flanking. So if you put this next to the fighter, it'll fight with his base attack and saves, and it will take 3 people to flank him instead of 2.
Very cool. What else do we have?
Next one is Freezing Fog. I thought this was neat. It's just one of those weird, versatile ones. It's Wizard Sorcerer level 5. It creates a 20-foot cloud of freezing fog, as per the name, It stops. It reduces all visibility down to 5 feet and reduces movement to 5 feet per round, regardless of normal speed. Okay. All melee attacks in the fog are at -2 to hit and damage. And range attacks are at -6, but spells are unaffected. And then, on top of that, every time the caster's initiative comes around, creatures in the fog take 2d6 damage of cold, and then they have to make a reflex save or fall over. All right. The next one is a set of spells. I've called it the orbs of assorted elements.
Okay.
All right, and it's a series of spells that just do, I think, a d6 or a d4 per level to a single target. There's one for the four elements. There might be a sonic one. I can't remember. And they also
what level are they?
Lesser flavors. I think 2 and 3, or maybe
okay.
It's 1 and 3.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's level 1 for the lesser orbs, and then level 3 for the regular ones.
Sure. I think I remember these being something like this being in the Tome and Blood 3.0 book. So.
Okay.
So let's switch gears here and tell me a little bit about the invocations for Warlock that are available.
All right. I'm going to skip the essence and the blast shape invocations just because there's so many of them on top of the ones that that simulate spells. The first one is Baleful. It's called Baleful Utterance. What it does is it's the shatter spell. And originally I didn't think it was any good, but I went back and read the rules for shatter, and it's just brutal. It can break any object up to 10 pounds per level, no matter what it's made of.
Okay.
And even if it's something that a person is carrying, unless it's a magic item, it gets no save. So you're just walking around every round, you're disarming somebody. And once you hit level 8 or so, you're breaking armor.
Start blasting your way through walls and doors and stuff to get in your way, you bet.
Yeah, it's just gross. And then you got charm, as for this spell, but you can only have one person charmed at a time.
Okay.
Then there's one called Dark One's Own Luck, which lets you add your charisma bonus to one of your 3 save types. This lasts 24 hours.
All right, so you get a save based off of your charisma. That's cool.
Right. So you get a third of the cool paladin ability.
Right.
The next one is called Spell Flight. It lets you fly at your land speed with good maneuverability for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got Walk Unseen, which is a self-only invisibility that lasts 24 hours. And that's sort of one of the things that breaks a class for me.
Yeah.
You've got a guy with at-will abilities who is always flying, always invisible.
All right, so I think we are ready to move into Chapter 5 then?
Yes, magic items.
Magic items, all right.
All right. I wasn't particularly impressed with many of the magic items. It was a surprisingly short chapter. With a book called Complete Arcane, I would have expected more than, say, 15, I think, there were magic items.
Mm-hmm.
There's some new weapon and armor abilities, but none of them are terribly interesting, so I'm skipping them.
Okay.
All right. The named magic items that I thought were interesting were Ring of Arcane Might, which makes the person wearing it count as a level higher for all level-dependent spell variables.
Mm-hmm.
So your fireball will do an extra d6. You save a level higher, all that kind of thing. That's a very cool one. Then you've got the Ring of Spell Battle, which allows the wearer becomes aware of all spell casting within 60 feet and can identify the spell with a spellcraft check. And once per day, the ring can automatically counter or reassign a target of a spell that you've identified with your spellcraft check.
Yeah, that is a really cool ring. I've looked at that one several times as I've made higher level characters. As I recall, it's pretty expensive too.
I think it is.
That's not something that you're going to be walking around with at a low level, so.
Well, that's good news.
Right.
And then the next one I liked was Sending Stones. They come in a pair, and then once a day, each stone can send a message to the other stone. And I thought about it, and either this is, depending on the situation and the group, it's either going to be really handy or a giant headache. And then the next one I liked is called Thought Bottle. It's got three different uses. You can store thoughts, memories, experience, or spells. Experience is the most interesting. It costs you 500 to do it, but after that, let's say you go out and you somehow lose a bunch of levels. You go back to your thought bottle and you go, okay, I remember all that stuff again. I'm back to my level.
Oh, okay. So it's a way to sort of store up experience points just in case you're ever drained of a level or you die in a raid and lose a level, that sort of thing. So you can sort of not be hit as hard by that.
It's more of a save button, but yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That takes us to monsters.
Is that chapter 6 then?
It is chapter 6.
Okay. What do we have for monsters?
All right, it's only got 3 creatures and 2 templates, so I'll go quick. The effigy creature, it is the mechanical animals made by the effigy master. This is where all the rules are in this chapter for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got Elemental Gru. They're small elementals, I think 2 hit dice.
Okay.
And they're described as small elementals that have been corrupted by evil. So they're all evil, and they're sort of like pollution versions of elementals.
Oh, okay.
And then the Elemental Monolith. It's another size bigger elemental. It's just gigantic. I think it's gargantuan is what they are.
Okay.
And then you got your 2 templates, the pseudonatural template from the Alienist.
Sure, the crazy things with the eyes and the tentacles in the wrong places.
Yeah, you gotta love that.
Yeah.
And then an undead-only template called Spell Stitched.
Okay.
And this also gives them spell resistance, damage resistance, some spell-like abilities depending on the hit die of the undead. The bonuses to save and turning resistance, which is cool.
So it gives a little bit of a magical bent to your undead creatures. You can make your special magical zombies and that kind of stuff.
Right, because magically animated corpses weren't magical enough.
Right, exactly. So those are the monsters. What's the, one more chapter left?
Yeah, our final chapter is chapter 7. It's a lot of DM stuff.
Okay.
There are several pages on how the general populace thinks about the different arcanists. You know, they think X about a warlock. They believe these things about a sorcerer, generally that they're unstable and scary.
Mm-hmm.
And this about wizards and so on. And then there's a section on the personality types that each type of specialist wizard seems to draw. You know, an abjurist tends to think like this and has this kind of personality. I'm pretty sure you said there was something like this in Complete Mage.
Probably, yeah. Sounds right.
Yeah, I thought that section was kind of silly, but people like it.
Well, it's sort of, you know, most of the book is a lot of crunch. You know, it's a lot of rules, it's a lot of stats, it's a lot of, you know, feats and classes and spells and that kind of stuff. And so this is the one chapter they give you that's a little more fluff, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, that is true. But I don't like being told how to play my character. But, you know, if I want to have a pacifist evoker, then I'm an idiot, but I'm going
to
do it.
If anything, I don't know that they're even necessarily trying to tell you how to play a character so much as trying to give you a place that you can go sort of fishing for inspiration. I know that's how I've used stuff like that in the past. But even then, it is sort of a gamble because, you know, I might look through it and be inspired by absolutely nothing, or I might pull out 2 or 3 really good ideas from something like that. And so, you know, is it worth giving up those pages for, you know, just anywhere between 0 and 3 ideas?
Well, maybe it was filler, and then they're all set.
And that finishes up the book?
No, after that, there's an interesting section on the arcane campaign. It gives suggestions for pacing and your arcanist. Like,
okay.
A fighter doesn't have a whole lot to do with his downtime, but a wizard is supposed to be out there researching spells and making magic items. And then it gives the idea of running an all-arcanist game and world-building with magic in mind. And then there's this section on, it's like 4 pages, 5 pages, on dealing with game-breaking spells and how to deal with them. I thought this was funny because the warlock gets half of those as at-will ability. And then there's stuff about organizations, the arcane order of mages, and the two bard ones, and the Wayfarers Union.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a short thing about epic progression for the three new classes, and that's the end of the book.
Well, very cool. There's a lot of good information in there. There's some things that it seems you really liked in this book. There's some things that you thought maybe were a little bit weaker in the book. All in all, what is the cover price of this book if somebody was looking for it?
It was $29.95, I think the book says. I gotta say that whether you're gonna run one of the prestige classes or, well, for a PC, if you're not gonna use one of the three classes, the three base classes or a prestige class, it may not be worth the $30 to pick up. But if you're a DM looking to surprise somebody, then then this is definitely something worth picking.
Okay, so if you're going to play a warlock, a Lugin, or a war mage, then you say this is worth the $30 that the cover price list. And if you're not going to play one of those, how much would you be willing to pay for it?
If I weren't running a game, $20, I guess, $25.
$20, okay. Well, I appreciate you coming on and doing this for the show. And sure. I know you've got plans to do some other things in the future for the show, and hopefully we can start counting you as a regular reporter for the Tome.
That would be good.
All right, I'm excited about that.
Well, there is Complete Arcane. As always, I urge and welcome listeners to help the show in any way you can. One of the best ways is to participate. Send in your emails or audio comments to thetomeshow@gmail.com. Let me know if you're interested in reporting for the show on a regular basis. Also, you can instant message me, join the Yahoo group, leave an audio, or call the Tome hotline at 206-888-6126. These, of course, can be found at the website at www.thetomeshow.com. You can also find links to Dig, so you can dig the show at dig.com, and Podcast Alley, or, of course, you could leave an iTunes review. All of these things help the show get noticed, and I really appreciate that. Also, don't forget to check out our partner podcast, Fistful of Comics and Games, who are gracious enough to provide me with domain hosting for the website and the forum. They are a great show that deals with comics, games, and all kinds of geeky goodness. And, of course, Gamers Haven at CanadianCrusaders.com for some great GMly advice. This has been episode 33, Complete Arcane of
The Tome. The Tome. The Tome. The Tome. The Tome. The Tome.